You ever get the feeling that everything in America is completely f***ed up?
They're saying I should think stuff. Something is wrong with me.
Practice. The show is called Positive Cynicism, but I don't feel we've been bringing the cynicism lately. I could be wrong. Maybe I just don't remember the shows that I do because I have really, really bad short-term, long-term memory. But that's all going to change. Not my memory, but the cynicism. Because in this episode, in the upcoming episodes, I have a feeling we're going to get a lot more cynical here. We're still going to remain positive because that's what the show's main intention is. It's to be positive, to spread positivity, to encourage you, the listener, to do something positive. But there's just a lot going on right now that the cynical side of me is jonesing to get out and come out and play. So fair warning that will be that's going to be happening soon. In addition to my cynicism, you can also check out all the other shows here on the Jittery Monkey Podcasting Network, My 123 Cents, Nerd United, Five Heart Podcast, probably some others starting this year at some point. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. You're just going to have to keep checking jitterymonkey.com and finding out what new stuff is on the way. Speaking of new stuff, be sure to go over to the shop section of jitterymonkey.com. Pick up a t-shirt because it's going to be summertime soon. You want new, stylish, fresh gear. So pick up a t-shirt that supports your favorite podcast and help us kind of pay the bills here on the Jittery Monkey Network. Please don't make us beg. Please don't make us set up a Patreon because we don't want to have to do that. Mainly because we don't want to see how much people don't want to support us. I'm just going to stop talking. We're going to play a commercial right here. And then on the flip side, we're going to come back with a discussion about realism versus escapism in pop culture. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Greg Mahochko, the host of Nerds United on the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. And over the years that I've been running the Nerds United show, I've been fortunate enough to speak with many of my talented friends, both artists and writers, creators of comic books. But I've also spoken with some more recognizable names in comics and entertainment. Legendary artist Greg Land. Hey, we Greg's gotta stick together. Writer Colin Bunn, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, and comic book creator DMC Daryl McDaniels, the Flash of yesteryear, and in more recent memory, Flash's dad, John Wesley Shipp, and a lot more. And I encourage you to subscribe to the Nerds United podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, or you can check it out anytime you want on jitterymonkey.com. And as founder of the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network, I really do appreciate your support. When you share a podcast, you help get our little corner of the podcasting world out to even more people. So anytime you do that, you really don't know how much we appreciate it. So share away.
Oh boy, skydiver!
Pull the chute!
Oh, I went too much to the right.
Maybe one of these days they'll let me play. They never seem to get tired of playing Atari. Probably because Atari has so many different games to play. Games like basketball, football, chess, bowling, outlaw. More than 30 games. But I never get to play.
I'll play with you, Daddy.
Thanks.
No other company offers you as many different video game cartridges as Atari.
Right, once again, I am joined by Eric Bennett, as I am every, usually second week of the month here on Positive Cynicism, and we're going to dive into pop culture issues that we think of usually about two or three days before we record. So it's all whatever happens in life that inspires us. Eric, welcome to the show again. How's it going?
Thanks for having me. It's going good. I can't wait to talk about all kinds of stuff today.
Awesome. Now, I know you and I kind of have a similar history of film, mm-hmm. kind of what we got into.
Yeah.
My first film, as I've mentioned on this podcast before, but the first film I ever saw in a theater was Star Wars. You know, before it was A New Hope, when it was just Star Wars. And that's what inspired me to kind of want to get into the entertainment industry. It you know, fostered my love of film. And then you had Steven Spielberg's E.T. and
The Dawn of the Blockbuster.
Yeah, all these films that you would go to the theater and you would just get lost in film.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I don't know if it's a growing trend or just because I'm getting older, my movie viewing habits, I guess, stretch wider than they used to. But there's a growing, again, I don't want to say growing trend, but I guess I watch more realistic films than I used to. You know, like off the top of my head, two films that come to mind are Kramer versus Kramer and On Golden Pond,
mm-hmm.
which as a kid, snooze fest. Yeah, I'm not going to watch those.
Yeah.
But now I recently watched On Golden Pond for the first time.
And mm-hmm.
incredible movie.
I think I saw it when I was younger and I was bored, but I'm going to take your lead and probably watch it again.
Okay.
I heard it's great.
It's a great, yeah. It's really good acting and writing, but it's kind of it's a real life film of just these two old people watching a kid up in the cabins.
Isn't it like a father and daughter bonding, like estranged and bonding familial story?
I mean, it stars Henry Fonda and Jane Fonda.
Yeah.
And I thought Jane Fonda had a bigger role in the film than she actually does.
Yeah.
But it's more about her. She's dating Dabney Coleman, which I found interesting because it's like the film right after that they did right after 95.
Yeah. Yeah. Great film.
And so they're going to Europe. And so they leave Dabney Coleman's son, who is played by, I believe it's Peter McNichol, who went on to Mischief a couple of years later. They leave him with Henry Fonda and Katharine Hepburn.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
He's like the, you know, the smart-ass kid that doesn't want to be there. And so it's more like the bonding between the father and,
oh, okay.
and the kid. And then when Jane Fonda comes back and sees them bonding, she's like, well, why didn't I ever get that as a kid?
Yeah, generational relationships.
Yeah.
That's cool. I'll
so, but again, it. Good film. But
great actors.
The other night, according to... when we record this, I started watching Black Klansman.
Mm-hmm.
Friend had a screener. I was watching it. And after about 15 minutes, I just turned it off because I realized I had zero interest in watching the film based on the content of the film. And it's, I don't know the full detail of the film because, again, only 15 minutes in, but it's about race relations and, an African-American infiltrating the KKK and the, which I guess... supposed to be in the late 70s. In the movie, it takes place in the early 70s.
David Duke is in there, right?
Yes. I believe Topher Grace plays him.
Later. Yeah.
I did not make it that far.
15 minutes. That's well short of the running time.
Well, yes, but that is about my average for actually watching something at home.
But if you weren't feeling it, you weren't... I mean, there's no obligation. I had this discussion last week with somebody, and I pull the plug on stuff all the time, especially Netflix. There's so much garbage, and it goes on for 10 hours, and I just gave up on The Punisher, and... there's this Haunting of Hill House or something like that. I'm ready to pull the plug on that too. So it goes that way with movies. Like if the movies, there's something going on and I guess you're going to tell me about it. Mm-hmm. I have yet to see it and we can talk about that too. But, there's no shame of walking away. If you're not having a good time or it's not interesting. And I'm curious on what was bothering you about
it. Okay. And that's the thing. It's like, I actually think it's an interesting topic and I was curious to see the story, but I guess getting into it, I was just like, I don't need to see a film about race relations right now because I can go on social media, I can watch the news and get this all the time. It's just, and so I got to thinking that when it comes to films now, I want more escapism. I want that feeling as a kid watching mm-hmm. Star Wars or E.T. where I just want to forget the real world exists for 2 hours, 2.5 hours, and just immerse myself in a story that has no binding to reality.
Yeah, I mean, I totally get that. I mean, I think my moods on that vary. Sometimes I feel that way. And there is something to be said about you get a big dose of real life in real life. Mm-hmm. And then when you turn down the lights, you may want to go somewhere else that's not what you're hearing about or reminds you of something you may know something about. Some people like to escape. I wouldn't use the word escape, actually. They like to revel in something that dramatizes something that's important to them in real life, which is, I think, what that movie is appealing to. And I think it's totally okay that your taste may have changed and you may be going back to a form of cinema that you had when you were younger where you did like to just escape in these fantasy worlds. And I don't see anything wrong with that because there's no requirement. that you need to watch documentaries, which I actually enjoy. There's no requirement that you need to watch dramatizations of real life things, which I think often in the biopic is the worst example, or in this case, for my argument, the best. It's like those movies are so formulaic, and I just saw Bohemian Rhapsody, which was awful. Great music, good central performance, but I was like, I'd much rather go on YouTube and watch clips of Freddie Mercury than watch a film where they get 10% of it right and they're just lip syncing to Freddie Mercury. And I think what you're talking about too is about like social issues, and you get all that all day long, social media, news, all that. And then you're turning off the lights and you're back into it again. And it's like this serious type thing. And I'm not, frequently I'm not in the mood for that. Yeah. So I put off watching it probably for that same reason. Just because I read up on this stuff and real life stories that impact people, which is highly interesting and draining and infuriating and hopeless and all these weird things. And then sometimes I just don't feel like going back into that world, like at 9 o'clock at night. So maybe that's what you're referring to.
Possibly, because the next night, I was flipping through the channels and CNN was showing Three Identical Strangers.
I actually want to see that.
It's interesting. It's a CNN film, which is why CNN was showing it.
Mm.
And I saw the preview when I went and saw the Mr. Rogers documentary last summer.
Excellent. And it totally robbed from the Oscars. And you know the Academy is clueless when they don't nominate that movie.
That was very
upsetting for me.
But watching, so the story of Three Identical Strangers sounded very interesting. So I ended up watching it. And I don't think it was a good documentary, per se. And I can see why it wasn't nominated for Best Picture or Best Documentary. But it's an interesting story, and it's a real story. But and I think that I have no problem with, because I guess this is where the element of what you're kind of saying with the biopics is actual truth versus manipulated truth.
Yeah, dramatized versions, which frequently, and you can spot it when you're watching, we're like, I don't know if that really happened. And then you look it up on Wikipedia, or something else that maybe sourced better than that, and go, oh, that didn't happen. And Bohemian Rhapsody has all kinds of that. It's infuriating.
Yeah, I mean, I like Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah.
But I'm not a huge Queen fan. I know, like, the hits, and I know the later years of Freddie Mercury's life. But the only problem that I really stuck out to me in that movie was the AIDS diagnosis before Live Aid.
And which didn't happen.
That didn't happen until years later. And the fact that they made it look like Queen had been broken up for a few years before Live Aid.
Yeah, and that the big linchpin in their problems was that Freddie Mercury was doing a solo album, but I guess two of the other band members had already done solo albums.
Yeah.
So how can you spin a fulcrum of a movie on something that, if you take the context, that's not really what happened? Or maybe they were arguing because they were doing separate projects. Maybe that's what they were hitting on, but anyways, we could talk about Bohemian Rhapsody for a while. I did enjoy it. I actually was moved to almost tears towards the end because I love Freddie Mercury so much. But if you're going to get one shot at telling a story, and I don't know if Klansman did this effectively, I'm definitely going to watch it. To me, it's like you're going to do that through a documentary, or you do that through a book or something more in-depth. So you can't really tell that person's story in 2 hours. You can only touch on it. And there's been a few biopics that I've liked and a couple real-life subjects I've liked. Schindler's List is based, I think that might be probably a good example that would contradict what we're saying, where I really can only watch that like once every 5 years or so. But it took a subject that mostly stuck to what actually happened, because I did some reading on it, and it dramatized a way. It was very profound. But again, you have that in the hands of a master, and I haven't seen Black Klansman, but Spike Lee is a little up and down for me, so it can go wrong, I think, more than it goes right. Schindler's List is when it went right, but I don't always know if they get it right, because most of the time when I watch it, they don't get it right.
And obviously they're going to dramatize events for storytelling purposes. You're going to condense people into one character or change timelines around. And that's with Black Klansman, from what I was reading, is the story took place in the late 70s, but they moved it to the early 70s for the film because they wanted to incorporate something with Nixon into the film.
That's interesting.
So, I mean, since we're on the topic of biopics, I don't know if you ever saw Beautiful Mind.
I did. I didn't care for it.
I am of the mind that Akiva Goldsman should be barred from ever writing more films. Not just because he did Batman and Robin.
Oh, boy.
But I remember a quote from Entertainment Weekly with him, and he was talking about, as far as the story of A Beautiful Mind, there's a guy named John Nash, who's a brilliant mathematician, and is schizophrenic. That's all their movie has in common with the real life story.
Yeah, I didn't do any homework on that. I just felt that there was false moments throughout it. And I can't even tell you what they are. It's just you watch it and you're like, they're dramatizing this, or that didn't happen. You just feel it. You know something's not right, or something's accelerated because they feel like they need to get to the next scene. Yeah. And it really takes away from the real life person that it's based on.
Yeah, and I think if you're going to do that, then don't make the movie about that person. Use that person's story or life as the jumping off point, but then create your whole new narrative, new characters, new story.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. And I think, again, the problem is that they'll do a lot of these movies and then the actors don't look like the people they're playing, or they're kind of cartoon versions. And that time is always better spent just reminiscing on that person's life. Again, I would say, if you really want to know about someone, read their biography or autobiography. Go on YouTube. I find YouTube immensely useful for all kinds of reasons, but it's really good for archival stuff. For all the garbage that's on YouTube, it's amazing. We're all like, think of, My Left Foot's one of my favorite movies of all time. It's based on Christy Brown. And they did an actually excellent job, because it's one of my favorite movies, so obviously I liked it, of doing My Left Foot and recreating his life. But then I actually found an interview on YouTube and I got to actually see him. Doesn't look like Daniel Day-Lewis. Daniel Day-Lewis is much more handsome. But he did a great job. But then I got this, and within 5 minutes of that, I got so much of the soul of that man and character and the way he talked, because he has a disability, that I was like, my whole perspective on that movie changed within 5 minutes. And movies can't capture that. They can capture something similar in terms of what happened historically, if they're being accurate. But sometimes the real thing is better. That's why I like documentaries a lot. Mm-hmm. I always prefer a documentary over a biopic, just straight up across the board. There's very few exceptions.
No, and you mentioned Daniel Day-Lewis, but you look at Christian Bale. Mm-hmm. And if you've seen The Fighter, you know, at the end of The Fighter, they show the real life person. And Christian Bale did a good job of mimicking him. But it's the same thing where after that movie came out, like, I went back to YouTube and found the fights that were recreated in the film.
Was it Mickey Ward, or who was it?
I think something like that.
Yeah, I like that movie, actually. Yeah. The Fighter was pretty entertaining.
But yeah, it's the real life story is so much more interesting. For the most part. I mean, there are some where, yes, the biopic is much more interesting because they took a story like that wasn't anything and made something out of it. I'm going to switch gears. And another, kind of going off this realism versus escapism, another issue that I've been having over the last year or so is violence in films.
Mm.
And I don't know if you saw Widows.
I haven't seen it.
There's a scene, the guy from Get Out, Daniel...
The lead?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I can't think what his last name is, and I'm not going to try to butcher it here.
Yeah, he's good in Get Out.
He's good in this movie, but he plays like he's the younger brother of this Chicago politician who they kind of run kind of, I guess, for lack of a better term, mob policies.
Mm.
And there's one scene where his associates have kidnapped two guys, and he's making them rap for him. He's like, oh, that was really good. Do it again. And they start rapping, and he pulls out a gun and shoots him in the face. And it's like, it's too realistic for me, where, and again, going back to social media and news and what we hear about so much in the gun violent culture that we live in and that people complain about, where I don't like seeing it on film, because it's a reminder of what we deal with in real life.
Yeah, that's a tricky one, because I, growing up, didn't see a lot of violence on TV, and then it just hit some kind of a tipping point. Mm-hmm. And then once the MPAA and the studios decided they can keep moving the line, I mean, Spielberg moved the line with Raiders of the Lost Ark. They just let him get away with some really brutal scenes because he was Steven Spielberg. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a big moment there. And then they kept pushing and kept getting away with it because the box office was there. And we could definitely say that kids got more and more used to seeing horrible things, and they just became more and more desensitized. So none of this is a good thing necessarily, but I always feel like with sex and violence, they kind of reflect the society. Like, they're not the ones dictating, like, what, I think there's this thought out there, and maybe you have this thought, and I don't, that music or art and stuff, they create these things, and then people either react to them, or they're setting the lead for these things. But really what they think they're doing is they're emphasizing things that we either see in real life or that people are kind of attracted to. So because I think our society is violent, you see movies that are violent. So you don't probably, obviously you don't like violence in real life, and you're finding a distaste for it in movies. I totally get that. But I think the movies exist because people want to see it, and people are seeing it in real life. So if you live in a non-violent society or a non-sexualized society, I don't think you'd have any of that out there. So I don't think the movies are introducing something that isn't already in the society. They're only just mirroring. I think entertainment and arts like mirror what people are thinking about and attracted to. And that says a lot about who we are. So we have a very violent society, 14,000 gun murders a year, you know, 2 to 3 times that in injuries. So when you see people getting shot up all the time, is it that surprising in movies? It isn't to me. And the music's violent too, because this music comes, some of this music comes from communities which are very violent, you know, in real life. But you probably don't want to see it either way, you know?
Well, it's, and you bring up the point, it's the argument that we made back several episodes ago in the topic about Mr. Rogers here on Positive Cynicism, mm-hmm. Is it society? Does society reflect pop culture, or does pop culture reflect society? And I think it's, I think it's probably a 50-50 blend. I don't think one is.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, one probably influence. They probably both influence. I would say they definitely influence each other. Mm-hmm. I think we may disagree about the percentages.
Okay. Yeah, I just think it's, you can't blame one thing, because I mean, I go back and yes, my views have changed over time as I've just experience more life and research more. But, you know, I remember after Columbine, it was the blame was put on Doom, Marilyn Manson, mm-hmm. The Matrix, all stuff. And I, you know, at the time I was like, no, this is not, these people did not do this because of these, so, you know, influences.
Yeah.
They did it because they're evil people who wanted to kill people. But now I look at it and go, okay, but do we have a oversaturation of violence in movies? I mean,
yeah, because our society is oversaturated with violence, so it's reflecting that.
But then I go back to like the escapism part, where has the violence become too realistic? Like in my, you know, going back to video, going looking at video games, my first system was the Atari 2600. One of the first games that came with it was a game called, it's not combat, although it did have combat, which was 2 tanks shooting, but there's a game called Outlaw.
Oh, I was going to say that, the cowboy one.
The Outlaw, yeah, but it was 2 stick figures shooting a square pixel. Yeah. Whereas now you pick up, you know, Red Dead Redemption or Grand Theft Auto, and you have realistic characters committing realistic violence. So does that play a part in the psyche of people to kind of desensitize faster or more intensely?
Yeah, I think that's where you probably have me the most challenged, because I love playing those things, but I don't love that younger kids are playing those things, and that's who's playing those things. So the fact that young kids are playing these games and that they exist, like I'm a freedom of speech guy, so I believe if you want to make a game where you go around shooting people and people want to, you're allowed to do that. There's no law that says you cannot do that. And do I like age restrictions on content? Probably not. But in this case, it probably makes sense, because the youth is absorbing this and they can't process sometimes what's real and what's not, and what's cool and what's kind of grotesque. So when I play Grand Theft Auto, I think it's kind of a joke and a cartoon, and it's a violent fantasy. So I'm going in this violent fantasy world that I actually kind of really enjoy. Lets off some steam, and I know none of this is real. I'm not going to do any of this stuff in real life. But if I'm a kid who's kind of forming thoughts and opinions, and I see women objectified, and I put a bullet in somebody's head, and then say there's some kids at school that actually have guns, you start blurring the lines between, you know, treating people a certain way and looking at people a certain way and objectifying people. But I think that's a society we've built to where it's just catering to that audience. And I think we've gone past the line where we can return from that. So I believe the parenting and the society isn't strong enough and disciplined enough to make sure the kids either don't make those choices, or when they do make those choices, they leave it in context. And to me, it's all about education. And not to get too much on a diatribe here, but I think if kids are, I think intelligent people make intelligent decisions. And I think if people really know, and I know kids who play violent video games, and when they come from like a good school background and stuff, they know it's a joke, it's a cartoon. But then I don't know if other people are viewing it the proper way. And I think a lot of it has to do with how smart we're raising our kids and what limits we're putting on them. And if you're the type of, and parenting has kind of softened, obviously, throughout the decades. So as parenting has softened and these kind of weird things have come up, you see this confluence of things that it's not good. So yeah, I don't advocate it for younger people whatsoever, but I wouldn't abolish it. I don't know what you would do, but I don't think I would put it away.
I'm with you. I'm a huge freedom of speech proponent, so I think obviously you have the right, but you hit on a good point, and I know you and I both do not have kids, so we may be talking out of turn here, but I do see that the parenting over the last 22 decades or so have seemed to shift from parenting to friendinking.
Yeah.
It's not really a word, and I really should have thought about that better. But instead of laying down limits and being restrictive on certain issues, because, I mean, I know as a kid, you know, granted, we had cable. I wasn't supposed to be watching R-rated movies. Well, my parents both work, so, you know, after school, whatever's on,
yeah,
I'm going to watch. But by that same token, it's, especially in video games, where our generation is the generation that grew up having the home arcade system. And now, instead of putting the arcade, the system away and becoming adults and saying, you know, oh, these are for kids, now adults are playing the games as well. So if you have a parent who's into video games and they have kids, are they playing along? Are they, you know, are they differentiating to that kid, like, you know, this is fake, don't do this in real life? Or is it just, oh, look, let's go, you know, steal a car, kill some hookers, and rob a bank? I don't know.
Yeah, I think you tapped on a good point that the parents are becoming younger. Mm-hmm. So as they grow up more desensitized and more into the gaming and entertainment cultures that have pushed those lines, they're going to have kids and they're going to relate more to what the kids want to do. And technology has really challenged parenting, to be fair to parents here, mm-hmm, for a second, to where I'm not sure if all parents understand the technology and how serious it is and what is going out there, because beyond video games and all that, there's pornography and there's other stuff online. Do they put limits on the computer, the browsing, all that? So, yeah, I'm very concerned about it. But again, I think much like things in America now, they're just, it's a train that's going ahead and it's not going to stop. Mm-hmm. So no one is banning it or outlawing it. And if parents are allowing it and kids are doing it, then there's no changing, because the video game industry in particular is overtaking the movie industry in profits. So that's what drives the country, is, you know, what people are doing, what people are talking about, and how popular things are. And you're not going to take away things that are popular and fun to people just because you don't care for them. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, I agree with you. Some of the stuff needs to be out of young people's hands, but that's not going to change. It's only going to go the other way. So that's my positive message for the listeners and you today. We're heading that way, and it could be worse in 10 years than it is now.
I think every generation will say the generation past them is worse than my generation.
Oh, yeah, they're all worse. Yeah. They're all worse.
Do you play Fortnite?
I played it, yeah. I played it for a little bit. I suck at it.
Okay. My nephew is addicted to the game. Every time I go home, he's playing it nonstop. I have no idea what the game is supposed to be because I don't understand it. But it's... I would say it goes back. It is bringing what we're just saying backwards a little bit, to where the violence in that isn't as realistic as a
Grand Theft Auto. It's a more family-friendly killing simulator.
Yes,
it's based on a cartoonish graphics engine, mm-hmm, and just to explain it to you real quick, it's actually a very simple game. It's squad-based combat. Mm-hmm. So you're dropped on an island. I don't know if you play with a team or not, but you're dropped on an island. And you have to get rid of other players. And you have a bevy of weapons and little things you can build to get away and build up defenses. But it's kind of like a Hunger Games, okay. Basically. So you just kind of drop the island, you got to fight people with weapons.
Yeah, I just wouldn't watch any, like, there's so much going on that I can't, like, he's, like, building and jumping and shooting.
Yeah.
And I'm like, slow down. Let's take this back.
It's a fast game.
But I'll compare that to, you mentioned cartoon graphics. You know, the cartoons we grew up with, namely He-Man, G.I. Joe, Transformers.
Yeah.
Violence in all of them. But it was a cartoony, like, I mean, the biggest joke with G.I. Joe is these are the you know, two elite army squadrons who can't kill anybody because they be running at each other, shooting, and completely miss.
Very low casualty count, like zero.
Yeah, they're like stormtroopers, basically. So, in that regard, where even though you had the violence, you didn't have violence, per se. Whereas now, and you look at the superhero movies of today that have violence, but again, it's cartoonish. Like the Avengers, like I think most superhero films, one of the biggest problems I have with them is the villain is always like a CGI creature or alien race that doesn't invoke a lot of emotional response. But maybe that's a good thing because you're taking the violence into the cartoony world of escapism.
Yeah, I think Disney's done a really good job with their movies and making family-friendly like superhero movies. Mm-hmm. Whereas DC, I think, had serious missteps with Superman, and he was, you know, Zod was slaughtering Metropolis, and he broke Zod's neck, and which was really distasteful and disgusting, and that's why they're backing out and doing more hopeful movies like Aquaman and Wonder Woman. But even Wonder Woman had some death in it. But I think it was telling an historical, I think it was World War One. So it actually was kind of cool. They mixed in a little history with it, a little bit of cost of what it takes to battle. But I think what we're speaking about is like the loss of innocence for youth. And we had that growing up because like I would see a slightly violent image when I was 13. I'd be like, oh, my God. Or like, you know, sexuality was somewhere like you were barely exposed to it. And it was kind of nice to be in this kid bubble for a while and then slowly grow out of it and become an adult. And I think now the images and experiences that adults and kids have are kind of the same. Especially again, mixed in with pornography, which I'm very concerned about, especially with younger kids. Again, we can't walk it back. So I think it's going to be an unfortunate, side effect of technology. Like once the internet came out and we could see and do anything we wanted, that went all the way down to kids. Because if you're going to allow a kid to get on a computer or have a phone, then there's nothing they can't access. And once they access that, they can't unsee what they're unseeing and they're going to get into certain things. And it's unfortunate, but I think we were lucky that we didn't have that problem. We didn't have the internet growing up, and we didn't have technology, and we didn't have these mediums getting extremed to where they're at now. Yeah. So we were lucky, I think, in a sense.
I agree with you. And you mentioned pornography, which is prevalent. I mean, it's at your fingertips now. You know, you don't have to sneak into your dad's bedroom to steal his copy of Playboy. It's just right there.
I don't know. I read something once that was 80% of internet traffic, and the Daily Show said that it's, or was it Bill Maher? I can't remember. They said that Netflix and all these things combined don't equal the viewership of pornography on a single day. So that's another positive thought for the day.
Yeah. Well, and there's the line from Scrubs. Dr. Cox says, you know, if you took all the pornography off the internet, there would only be one webpage, www.bringbackthepornography.com.
Oh my God. That's good.
But this is something, and I actually was having this conversation earlier today when we record with another friend. Is, I guess, because of the Me Too movement, now I have started, like, viewing nudity in films differently. Whereas...
Like modern films?
Like modern films. Like, I mean, as a kid, we grew up, again, in the heyday of the 80s, the teen sex comedy, Porky's, Mischief.
Yeah.
You know, all these things that, as a teen, you know, early teenager or teenage, you're like... You know, waiting to watch Porky's because you're like, oh my gosh, we're gonna see nudity, and it's that thrill of it. But now, as an adult, after the Me Too movement, when I see nudity on film, I'm like, okay, what went on behind the scenes? You know, this character is an actual person who now, years later, if she decides, wow, I wish I hadn't done that. Well, the film's out there. Screen captures are gonna be all over the internet. You're never going to get rid of it. You know, is it a taking advantage of someone to get a shot, or is a person doing it willingly just because, you know, they're okay with it, or are they doing it because, well, if I want this job or if I want a career, then I have to do it.
Yeah, so that's starting to make you feel like when you watch those scenes, it's kind of taking you out a little bit, and you're going, what's going on with that?
Yeah.
Was this the only roles that were out there for her? And I think that's all that stuff is like, it's like many things in life, all that stuff is true. Mm-hmm. But again, it's a lazy answer, but I'll say that this just reflects like what people are interested in or who's making the movie would be more important. So if you have a bunch of guys making a movie, this is, or more importantly, probably writing the movie and even casting it, And these people are going to write what they're interested in. And because the movie industry has been stuck in this loop for a while, and that's why people think movies have gotten stale, and they have in some large measure. That's why you see all the sequels and, oh, okay, this woman's playing this role again. I've seen this before. And you have to go out and see different types of cinema. But because the same kind of system's in place, and you have a lot of male writers and I think male directors and producers, and it actually, the farther you go back, the worse it gets. Mm-hmm. So I think the one positive is that with the Me Too movement and more women, and clearly not enough, making films and writing films, that's what's going to combat this. If you have, but because of these movements, I think you're going to see films that get away from that. So I think you're going to still kind of, you know, get weirded out, still seeing stuff, but I'm seeing a lot less of it. Like, it used to be in the 80s, like, all the women were like sex objects.
Yeah.
And occasionally you get a good role or a good movie for a woman, but there's just a lot of those teen comedies, or even I was watching Airplane, and I'm like, oh my God, they're just showing frontal nudity for the hell of it. And it's, you could say maybe there's a joke there or something, but it's like, well, that's a little tacky there. But I go back, and we had a podcast on this, and it's like, well, at the time, that was like what people were into. Right. And the people that were writing it didn't care because that's what other people were writing. And I think you'll see in 2020, 2025, if we revisit this on a podcast, we'll be like, wow, this is not, you know. I think if you go back, it's just so much worse. Like, I think we talked about this before, but I saw a James Bond movie where basically Sean Connery, like, told a woman, you're having sex with me, push the door or whatever. And that was pretty common. Like, no, you can't say no to me. And think about where we're at now. We're not there anymore. What I worry about, and all of that will correct itself, and we need more, we need different voices in Hollywood. But I think what I'm a little bit concerned about is with the Me Too movement is there's also, there's a flip side of that coin where there's, like Robert De Niro there, there's also like politically correct stuff entering where like you can't do anything taboo because you're worried about what someone's going to say about it. And that would be very unfortunate, being lost in art. We can't make, look, Hollywood art's already made by committee anyway. But we can't check in with everybody to make sure something's okay before we make it. So if you're a writer, write your truth, write what interests you or titillates you. And if the audience rejects it, that's fine. You're not going to get sued for writing a sexist scene or a racist scene. You'll just be fired out of Hollywood, or people won't see your movie. So let people, again, freedom of speech, do what they want to do. And if people, and if women don't want to play those roles, don't take those roles. And if you're, say you're from the Middle East and like, I'm not playing terrorists anymore. Easy for me to say, just don't play terrorists. And we need to have more Middle Eastern filmmakers. So I think this will trend in the right direction, but we can't make a movie where we say you cannot do these things because they're unsavory. You know, if people want to put up the money and write it, then let them do it. And if it gets rejected, that's what they had coming, you know?
Yeah, I think going back to the sex part real quick, it's that used to be very gratuitous. There is no point for sex. Like you said, an Airplane, you know, there's just a shot of turbulence, you know, plane hits turbulence, there's a naked woman bouncing up and down. You look at a movie like Basic Instinct or Body Double, where you can say like, okay, the nudity is driving the plot.
Yeah.
So that's a different case. But when you just have, you know, an actress, getting out of the shower or getting out of bed, and like, okay, what does this scene add to the story? Nothing, then, you know, have her wear clothes, or, you know, you don't need to see the nudity in it to get the same story.
Yeah, and I think that's a very good way of looking at it. And I think we'll continue to evolve there. I think, you know, if the older generation's got a way to go, I don't know if they're always going to be there, but I think the young people coming up and then turning in their middle age and all that, they'll watch these movies and like, I'm not supporting this movie, or I'll turn the channel, or it's tricky though with sex, because like the female body has been used to sell everything. So that will never be taken out of society. Maybe in 100 years it will be, but we use women all the time to sell products. We don't usually show men selling, you know, fashion and all that. So they still have beautiful women on the news. They have beautiful women selling clothes. They have beautiful women selling movies and beautiful women singing music. And they're using their own agency to sell themselves with their appearances sometimes. So to say like, if they're in a movie and I'm going to show a beautiful woman, you know, it's a selling point, I think, sometimes for the show. And do we find it distasteful? Yes, it's probably distasteful. But I'm not sure that's going to stop anytime soon, because that's still, people tend to take notice of beautiful women. And to be fair to everybody all the way around, beautiful men as well. So that kind of beauty still sells. So it's being exploited, but it's been exploited in every other facet of our society.
True. And I hope that it is kind of on the downward trend now. But, you know, I remember the first time I saw Lady Gaga in concert.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one point where she was at the piano by herself. The band was off stage. Amazing song, amazing voice. She's wearing a leather bikini. Why? Because it's the sex selling, you know, attractiveness factor of, instead of focusing on the talent, I'm going to focus on the sex.
Yeah, that was my thing with Madonna that I didn't like, is that I didn't think she was a great singer, or she was a pretty good dancer and all that, and she had entertaining songs, but it was always wrapped around this sexual image that I know, talking to a lot of women, they find her incredibly powerful and inspirational, and I'm not going to take away from, you know, you'd have to interview one of them to find out, because I would never want to speak for them. But for me, it was always like off-putting, because I felt like there wasn't a lot of talent there. It was more of like an image. And I just thought, that's not all a woman represents. So as a young man, I was like, oh, that's cool. She looks beautiful. But as I got older, I was like, those songs aren't the greatest songs. And it's just her kind of parading around in an outfit. And I'm like, and I would say the same thing if it was a guy. Like, if there's a guy who's playing mostly off of sex appeal and he's not the greatest singer in the world, I'd be like, well, that's all he's got. And it's unfortunate that that's their trick. But people in these industries, they use whatever they can to get their foot in the door. And I totally get it. I don't think Lady Gaga needs to do that, though. And she's got a lot of talent.
And it's not just getting the foot in the door, but it's getting that recognition where you have to do something to stand out. Because, you know, especially here in Los Angeles, you can go on pretty much any street corner and find a musician or mm-hmm. find an act. You can go into any coffee shop and find an actor.
Yeah.
But what makes them stand out from everyone else? And yeah, so that's where Madonna, Lady Gaga, Prince, they all had an image that was bigger than, I don't want to say bigger than the talent, because they're all very talented, but it made them stand out amongst everyone else that came out at that time.
Yeah, and Freddie Mercury, and like you get Mick Jagger, like you get these confluences of when there's an image behind it and there's the talent. Mm-hmm. And that's when there's like an all-time performer. But I think some of the stuff is very Freudian, and I think we'd be remiss in saying that there's a reason this is appealing. Like, so for every performer that's doing this, you'd have to blame the 5,000 people that are buying into it in the arena, or the 10,000 people. And I think it says a lot, and I think overarching a lot of this conversation, it says a lot about who we are. So this goes to politics, and this goes to anything else. Like, people are supporting people because they're responding to it. So you can blame the person, but really there's a movement, or there's an interest behind that that extends to all the individuals. So these things don't catch fire unless there's people who are interested in this stuff. Unless there's people playing Fortnite in the millions or Grand Theft Auto in the millions. And I think it says a lot about the breakdown of education, parenting, societal norms, and differentiating exploitative art, which I think we're really touching on here, which is mostly commercial art, and then art with integrity. And we're not a society. We're a young society here. We're not like the French, the Italians. We haven't gone through Renaissance periods. We haven't created the stage. We haven't. We've created some art forms like hip-hop music and the blues and stuff, but and bluegrass music, but there's a lot of things we have not created. We borrowed and we packaged and sold that I don't think we fully understand. So there's a lot of societies that go back hundreds of years that have this culture of art and literature, and I feel like that's what's lacking in America. So a lot of what's here is like, it's got to be commercial, it's got to catch your eye. We market all the way down to children and babies now. So when I look at what people are into and whether or not they're distasteful and all that, it's probably all true. But it says a lot about who we are and what our art industry is here, in which it's mostly commercial. It's not driven by creativity and integrity. That's why you're seeing all the sequels. And it's meant to, like, pitch me something that a lot of people are going to like, and I don't care what it is. That's what we're dealing with here. We're not dealing with make something like Bohemian Rhapsody. There was another version which was Sacha Baron Cohen, which was very artsy and supposedly delved into his debauchery and his downfall, and really was a character study, and they shelved it for like this very popular commercial movie that made hundreds of millions of dollars. Well, these decisions are being made all over the place. It's like, what can reach the most people? And that's where you get something dumbed down, the women are pretty, the things are violent, whatever will catch people's eyes. So there's not a lot of integrity. There's some people out there doing really good work, and you see that in documentaries and smaller films, but still the dominant form of entertainment here is commercial, and that's just the industry here. That's what Hollywood's created, and it's spilled out into, we've Hollywoodized almost everything else. including music. Like, I think the Grammys are on next week, right?
Yeah.
That is, there's not one event on television I would want to skip more than the Grammys, because I used to watch the Grammys and kind of like who was going out there. And now when I watch the Grammys, it's the same four people singing songs that sound identical. Now I'm the cranky old man, but.
Exactly. No, you make a good point. I think we've discussed it on the show before. It is, we go back and again, we idolized or we romanticized the 80s because that was our childhood innocence.
It's the best.
Time.
It's still the best.
Still the best. But it's a time when you look at the radio and MTV playing all sorts of different genres of music.
Yeah.
You look at the movies that were coming out. You had drama, teen comedy, action movies. You had everything that, you know, different genres for different likes. Now everything is fit into one bag because it's, let's get, instead of making five films that 20 people are going to see, let's make one film that 100 people are going to see.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I like that the studios are putting out, I mean, I do like my Marvel movies, of course, and Star Wars, so I'm a hypocrite there, but largely I'm not a big fan of what the studios make, but what I do like the studios have done is they have these little subdivisions that acquire independent films, mm-hmm. like Sony Picture Classics and Searchlight,
yeah.
And I love A24. Like, A24 should be the model for every film studio. They take chance after chance after chance. They always make two or three movies that are in my top five of the year. So there's good stuff out there. It's just the problem is those aren't the movies that are making $200 or $300 million. But again, they're putting a lot of money behind something in these other cases, and you're getting a lot of junk being put back out. I still find myself drawn to film, but the only thing I do like about technology in this regard is that it's allowed me to seek out a lot of smaller films. Like, I just watched this Netflix series on dogs. And of course, being a dog lover, it has all these really profound stories about life and existence and humanity and what dogs give you. And it touches health issues and like helping disabled people. It touches poverty. It touches, you know, I've grown up with this dog my whole life and fished every day. And this dog is my backbone. And that was like, that piece of entertainment was so profound. It was the most moving thing I've seen all year. So the good stuff's out there. I just would hope that people educate themselves, stay off of Rotten Tomatoes, and kind of find better websites that will recommend top 10 lists. And I would recommend this for you, and I know you probably do it, but like, everyone will say, see Black Klansman. It's important. People will say, these Oscar winning movies, most time when I watch them, I just cannot stand them. Like, there's always this ultra serious kind of hack, dramatic importance put on it. And I leave feeling, I know what they were trying to make me feel and they didn't get there. So maybe that's just me being burned out on those type of movies. And I know it goes back to the beginning where you were saying some of these socio-political movies, you're kind of tuning out of because you get a lot of that in the real life. And I'm finding myself the same way.
Yeah. No, you make very valid points. And yeah, we've said it before, I'm sure, that there is enough good creative merchandise out there, whether it be film, music, television, art, whatever, but the companies are marketing to the largest audience possible. Yeah. So these niche films or niche products are not getting the same recognition. So, and that's, you know, you can say like Netflix has all these shows or whatever, but to me, I'm still struggling with, like, when you used to go to the video store and you could walk around and you could pick up the box, yeah, and you could see it and you could read, whereas now you go on Netflix and it's, depending on what you've been watching, it organizes everything differently. And so if you want to find these niche things without knowing that they're there, it's a little bit of a struggle, but.
Yeah, Netflix is absolutely horrible for what it recommends. And it's, I mean, it gets some stuff right that any algorithm could get right. Oh, you like documentaries. There's a new one based on serial killers. Well, I'm into serial killers. Well, you'll probably like that. It gets the obvious stuff right. But what I found is, a lot of the film festivals, and sometimes they have some real turds on there that I don't really enjoy, but that's just a personal problem with some of them. But a lot of times, some of those that win film festivals or they come from certain filmmakers, I kind of get wind of and then I write them down. And then when they come out on Netflix or iTunes, I have like a little list, and it really helps me like still believe in cinema. Because if I go on Rotten Tomatoes, they're just talking about movies that are in malls, and most of those are going to disappoint me, including some stuff that is nominated for Academy Awards. I'll see those movies and I'm like, oh boy, that was not interesting. But then some of these things that are coming out of festivals, or I go on blogs and I read about it, I'm like, I'm going to make that list, or A24 movies. And I found, and maybe you haven't found the sweet spot yet, I find that if I make this list and I seek them out, I generally am surprised at how good they are. And my faith in filmmaking is restored. But if I go to movies that are out, out in general cinema sometimes and not the Landmark, I'm not like an ultra film cynic where I just have to see the most important films that are really small. I see mass market films. But you have to do your homework going into it. And I feel like what's being presented to us, whether through a Netflix portal or through a lot of blogging, is like what everybody's into. And it becomes very watered down entertainment. And we've been around enough to see enough movies where we want to see something new. And maybe you need to find that sweet spot where you can see new stuff. Because maybe the stuff that's being recommended to you, Black Klansman, other stuff, it's not interesting to you. You know, it's not enough. It's something you've seen before.
Yeah, and I think maybe this will be a teaser for next month's podcast. But, you know, the Oscars are coming up, which is why I started watching Black Klansman.
Mm-hmm.
As of the recording of this podcast, I have zero interest in the Oscars this year.
Oh, I have never been less interested in the Oscars.
And it's because the stuff that is being nominated is just so Oscar baity.
Oh, completely.
Not Ned Beatty, who should be getting more work, but
yeah.
Is he still alive? But it's just, it's the most generic type of films that's being made. And I think it's
there are films that appeal to the Academy, mm-hmm. So they're very kind of weepy, dramatic. It's usually about people that are being oppressed, mm-hmm. and this and that. I think all those films have their place, and I've owned some of them, and I wouldn't use the word enjoy, but I watch them, and I get a lot out of them. But I can't. Sometimes it seems like that's all they select.
Yeah.
And there's no variety there. And then I was very surprised to see Black Panther show up. We can do an Oscar preview if you want for a podcast. Yeah. Maybe that's what you're talking about. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff on that list where I'm like, I have zero interest in watching it. And if when I read the synopsis of the film, I've seen something like that before.
Yeah, exactly.
And it appeals to the people in that room and not necessarily to, it doesn't, they're not, it's kind of the worst possible thing. They're picking stuff that's kind of popular that people think are important, but sometimes they're not picking the smaller films that really need to be highlighted. And they're not picking the mainstream films. They did with Black Panther, which isn't one of the better Marvel movies, I think. But then they don't pick some of the mainstream films that really deserve it. Like, I remember the year Get Out came out, I said, that is the best picture of the year. Did it win? I don't think
it was won. Nominated. May have won screenplay.
Oh, it should have won everything. But.
All right.
Well, anyways, that's
the answer. Anyway, we'll save that for next month. Give us your thoughts. If you know, what type of films do you like? Do you think we have some valid points? Do you think we're completely off base here? You can let me know either on the Facebook page for Positive Cynicism or hit me up on Twitter at Chad Smart. Eric, thanks again for this episode. Always a great conversation. And we'll see you. Well, I will see you next episode of Positive Cynicism. Eric will be back in a month. As always, question everything. And especially now, after hearing this conversation, go out and do something positive.
This is a production of the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. For more jittery shenanigans, go to jitterymonkey.com.